You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 344 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Danger Street number 7, Superman Lost number 5, World's Finest Teen Titans number 1, Unstoppable Doom Patrol number 4, Night Terrors number 1, Night Terrors Green Lantern number 1, Night Terrors Robin number 1, Night Terrors Shazam number 1, Night Terrors The Flash number 1, Night Terrors Zatanna number 1, and the Legion of Superheroes animated movie. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, up next for DC News, speaking to comicbook.com's Chris Killian for her new Netflix movie Heart of the Stone before the strike, Gal Gadot said that as she understands it, she will be developing Wonder Woman 3 together with Gunn and Safran. I love portraying Wonder Woman, Gal Gadot says. It's so close to, from what I heard from James and from Peter, is that we're going to develop Wonder Woman 3 together.
Honestly, Drew, it was pretty surprising news because I just kind of, I think with a lot of people, just kind of assumed that everybody was off. I mean, there were pretty strong rumblings that Momoa would have a strong chance to stick around as not Aquaman, with the likelihood being that he'd be Lobo. But again, that's pure rumor and speculation. I'm not upset. I mean, I think it's not a controversial opinion to say that I and many people really enjoy her as Wonder Woman. I have to say though, Drew, it's somewhat bittersweet though, because I think, especially after the Flash tanked, I think everybody sort of agreed that DC needed to hit a reset button and kind of cleanse themselves of the old film universe. Even though I do think there were good movies involved in that. They had completely lost the film audience, right? Like, the box office was just not going to be there anymore, I don't think. And so it made sense to move on. But to not move on from her means that you could have not moved on from something. Like, you know what I mean, Drew? Like, I really, really liked Henry Cavill. And I wish that he had gotten a better chance to play Superman, which I think he would have gotten with Gunn. That's the thing, Drew. Like, I would have loved to have seen Cavill get to be Superman with a competent director who understands the character, and he won't get that chance. I am very excited that Gal is going to get another chance to play Wonder Woman. Whether this is like a true next in line, though, or it's got to be, it can't just be the third film, though, right, Drew? Like, it's got to be some sort of soft reboot.
I don't think it's
otherwise we're going to get really confusing.
I don't think it's going to be a Wonder Woman 3. I mean, they're launching a new universe. We already know there's going to be a Themyscirian television show, if I remember right. Is it television show that's supposed to be Game of Thrones like. So, you know, it's going to be different from the movies. So the Wonder Woman that's coming has to be from that universe. You know what I mean? So I can't see it being. I can't see it being a third movie in that series. It has to be something new. I can understand why, you know, they'd want to continue with Gal Gadot though. I mean, she's a great Wonder Woman. So it'll be interesting to see how she does with a better script. You know what I mean?
Yeah, The first Wonder Woman was great. I mean, the third act I thought could have been slightly better, but I mean, overall, a great movie. The second one was silly, to put it lightly. So again, I'm not upset she's getting another shot at Wonder Woman. I think that's great. I'm very curious to see, Drew, what it's going to be like, because I think that's going to be, again, I feel like that's sending mixed signals of what's going on exactly with these films. I don't know. I don't know that it will matter, though, because she's so popular as Wonder Woman. Rightly so, to be clear, rightly so. So I don't know that that confusion is going to hurt that film, but I do wonder if it's going to be confusing for the rebrand overall.
I don't see it being that confusing. Though she's been, we've been seeing her in a lot of movies. She was in The Flash. She was in Shazam, Fury of the Gods.
Yeah.
Was she in Black Adam? I can't remember.
No.
No. Okay.
No, there wasn't anything other than Cavill, because that's what The Rock was hyper-focused on, setting up the two of them as the central focus.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So, you know what I mean? Like, not that you couldn't have had Wonder Woman there. If anything, I think Wonder Woman would have made a lot of sense for certain points. But God forbid you take the focus off of those two. So,
but she's been making cameos in lots of movies.
So what you're saying, Drew, is that in some way she's responsible for the two biggest flops?
No, I am not saying that. No.
I'm just saying it's the only thing they share in common, though. God, I hope she doesn't have a cameo in Blue Beetle either.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of curious. I have a feeling that with Blue Beetle, we're not going to see... I don't think we're going to see... I could be wrong, but I'm guessing we're not going to see any characters from the old universe. I have a feeling it's going to be more of a standalone movie.
I agree, Drew, because I think that allows this film to... Hypothetically, they've said that this is part of the newer DC movie universe. And I don't think, and we know that was definitely not the case when they were originally making it, right? So I think the only reason that they're able to get away with saying that and doing that is because the movie is likely so self-contained that it could be anything.
Which I'm excited because it's coming out really soon.
I am very excited to check out the movie. I am not excited for what is inevitably going to be the box office news with that film.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm not want to see what the box office is going to be either. I don't know. I think, wasn't this movie originally supposed to go straight to streaming?
Yes, Drew. And that's what it would be. It would be so well served at that, because if the film is pretty good, right? I'm not expecting a masterpiece, but if it's pretty good and it comes out on streaming, it's mostly just going to get positive buzz, right? Because people are going to be like, hey, that film was pretty good. There's no negative thing to report on that. But if the film is pretty good and it does what everybody seems to think that this film was going to, it's not just you and I speculating this. Like, this is, all of the box office predictions are predicting a disaster box office-wise for this film. And they're not always right, you know, but it doesn't have to be this way, Drew. That's going to be the focus of this. Everybody's just going to remember that the film absolutely tanked at the box office and have no regard for what the actual quality of the film was.
Flash hasn't even hit Max yet, so we haven't really seen anything more about that movie. I know it's available to buy digitally. Well, I don't know if there's that many people
I can't imagine
buying it.
If they weren't bothering to go see it in theaters, why would they be paying to?
Yeah, I haven't heard.
Going to wait for it to go on. I'm actually surprised it's not on Max yet, Drew, just to help change the narrative. Like, the narrative of this film has already been, for Flash, has already been written. It was a disaster. Now, to be clear, quality of the film-wise, I don't agree with that, but that's not what's going to get remembered. It's not what has been remembered. It's remembered as it was the nail in the coffin of the DC Universe. Financially, and clinging on to any hopes of lingering profits is just not there. It's just not happened. So I'm a little bit surprised they haven't put it on Max just to, like, get more eyeballs on the film and maybe hope that you get, like, a sort of cult following of, like, hey, this movie's actually not that bad.
Yeah. That's what I think they're doing, is holding out, trying to make more money. And it's not working.
It's a fool's errand. It's just...
I'm not that impressed with the new head of DC Discovery.
Zaslav's a nightmare, man. He's... It's not good stuff.
No.
DC is far from the only property poorly affected by his tenure. So that's a Warner Brothers on a whole problem that is I don't know when that's going to get, or if that's going to get resolved, Drew. That's the worst part is, honestly, with this DC universe that is hopefully going to find a nice rebirth under Gunn's leadership and Safran's leadership, they still both report to Zaslav. And nothing I've read suggests that that's good, Drew, so I don't know. I hate to be so pessimistic, but there is not a lot about the leadership above, to be clear, above the Gunn Safran duo that it makes you feel encouraged.
Yes. I have to agree with you on that. All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Ask yourself, is the Flopcast the right podcast for you?
Do you have trouble picking a favorite Weird Al song, Karate Kid sequel, or Justice League Detroit member? Are you obsessed with Cousin Oliver from the Brady Bunch, Vicky the Captain's Daughter from the Love Boat,
or Vicky the Robot from Small Wonder?
Do you think Cyndi Lauper's We Are the World solo is the most important event in history?
Do you have half an hour a week for something completely stupid?
Then the Flopcast might be the right podcast for you.
We're on the ESO Network
and at flopcast.net.
Hi, I'm Gina Schock from the Go-Go's, fabulous drummer of the Go-Go's.
Hi, this is Tony Levin of King Crimson.
Hi, this is David Fisher for the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp.
Hi, this is Richard Evans. I am the author of Listening to the Music the Machines Make.
Hi, this is Teresa Kariakis, punk rock photographer.
Hi, I'm Tom Bojour, author of Nothing But a Good Time, and you are listening to Modern Musicology.
Modern Musicology.
Modern Musicology.
You're listening to Modern Musicology, so, you know, pay attention, you might learn something.
And we're back, but before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers. For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Danger Street number 7. 1 month later, Lady Cop is waiting to meet with a Commodore. Her appointment was at 11 a.m., but it is now 3:30 p.m. The secretary tells Lady Cop that the Commodore is running a tad behind and will be with her shortly. Abdul is relaxing on a beach, asking the waiter for a Shirley Temple. Abdul puts a towel over his face. Abdul changes his mind and tells the waiter to bring him 2 Shirley Temples instead. When the waiter doesn't answer, Abdul pulls the towel off his face to discover the Manhunter standing in front of him. The Dingbats are spray painting graffiti on a sign when Officer Cooper catches them. Officer Cooper arrests them. Jack Ryder needs to see the Commodore right away before he reads the script on air in about an hour. While waiting, Jack Ryder befriends the lady cop who reveals herself to be Liza Warner, Chief Liza Warner. Chief Warner informs Jack that she is here about a double homicide that is connected to the Green Team. On Apocalypse, Darkseid is not happy with Mantis's performance and drops him into lava. Highfather states that they are children and must be taught. Darkseid states that after all these millennia at one another's throats, they finally agree. When Officer Cooper books Non-Fat, he puts him in a cell with Warlord. They come up with a plan to break out in 8 hours. When Jack Ryder's meeting is finished with the Commodore, he decides to give Chief Warner his business card because he has a good friend that could help with her situation. Orion is in his street clothes at a bar drinking. He has failed in his mission to locate Atlas. When Mother Box responds to him out of the blue, he pours a beer on her, causing her to malfunction. Back on the beach, Abdul runs from the Manhunter into the ocean. The Manhunter follows him and runs right into a trap. The secretary tells Chief Warner that the Commodore will need to reschedule. When Chief Warner asks the secretary how she can just sit there every day working for the Commodore, we learn that he kidnapped her son Henry. If she doesn't do what she is told, she will get him back in pieces. Chief Warner decides to call Jack Ryder. To be continued. Now, Cletus, I had to laugh at the Mother Box thing because we have an Alexa here, right? And sometimes she'll say things out of the blue. So when the mother box started talking out of the blue, I found that freaking hilarious.
And then when he starts essentially trying to give the mother box a drink also, that was hilarious.
Yeah, that whole scene was funny.
I really enjoyed this issue, Drew, and it's interesting seeing some storylines convert. We saw a big convergence last issue, right? Everything kind of came together briefly. And now we're seeing new parties kind of joining. We've got the Outsiders have appeared to have trapped Manhunter and maybe are going to use him to kill the last member of the Green Team. We've got the boys trapped in jail with the guy planning the breakout. The cop teaming up potentially with the Creeper. Really interesting setup, Drew, for the second half of this story. I have to admit, I had forgotten briefly that the former Green Team member on the beach, I have forgotten that he had joined up with the Outsiders in the last issue, Drew. And so I just thought he was going to get murdered. And then when the Outsiders popped up, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm stupid. Like, of course they were there.
I hadn't forgot he teamed up with them. But when he's on the beach, I was wondering where the heck they were. I thought, okay, well, maybe they helped him escape. And then he's back on his own. I wasn't expecting him to be there either, so that surprised me too. I found it interesting that we started the issue off with Lady Cop waiting in the Commodore's office, and then we wrap up the end of the comic with her leaving the office. So she was basically there the whole issue. But it wasn't surprising that the Commodore basically blew her off.
You knew that was going to happen, like, within the first couple panels.
Oh, yeah.
Of that. I loved the conversation in the elevator where the secretary has been playing it very professional and cool the whole time. And frankly, even her explanation of what's really going on in her personal life and the threat that she's under, even that was so, like, matter of fact, right? While they're riding safely in the elevator.
Yeah, because she seemed...
What a great scene.
Yeah, she seemed like she... You know, while she's there in the building, she's detached herself from it. She probably has to.
Oh, she has to. You know she has to. My gosh, what a brutal working environment, knowing that her son's life is probably... This is the worst part, Drew, is you know that son's probably dead or going to die anyway, and she has no choice but to keep going because she can't, in a sense, be... Even though she's not responsible, right? In her mind, she'll be responsible for her son's death. And so she has to keep going. Oh, it's just brutal. Very effective writing.
Yeah, and it just shows you how evil the Green Team is. And they're a bunch of kids.
I know. Truly evil.
All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Superman Lost number 5. Day 15. Lois meets with Diana at a restaurant. Diana is concerned about Clark, but didn't want to intrude. Lois reveals that Clark is having problems adjusting to being back on Earth. It's too noisy after being in the quiet of space so long. Diana lets Lois borrow the lasso of truth. Clark has returned to work at the Daily Planet after being out with the flu. At least that was their cover story. When Jimmy tries to get Clark's attention, Clark calls Jimmy by the name Shimmy. Year 8 of Clark being gone, he's living on a planet with an alien woman named Hope and another male alien named Shimmy. Hope is a Green Lantern. Unfortunately for Clark, she is not connected to the Green Lantern network, and her ring only gives her a map of this local sector of space. Hope takes a shower and leaves the door open. When Clark walks by, he stops and stares at her naked body. She looks over at the door, but Clark is gone. Shimmy jumps out of bed when he realizes that gravitational lensing is the answer that he needed. Shimmy thinks he has found Clark a way home. When Shimmy shows Hope what he has found, Hope kills him, wanting Clark to stay with her. Back on Earth, Lois wakes up to the fire alarm going off. It looks like Clark has destroyed Lois's laptop with heat vision. Clark is staring out the window and tells Hope not to bother him. Lois repeats the name Hope and then grabs the lasso of truth. Lois wraps the lasso of truth around Clark's waist, and he realizes he is at home with Lois. Both fall to their knees and hug each other.
Drew, I liked some of the ideas in this comic and the overall feeling that he was going for in this issue, But I have to say, it was organized in a way that was made it very hard to fully grasp the sequence of events.
I totally agree with you because, you know, I ended up reading through it twice when I was trying to do my notes, trying to clarify everything. And it was hard to tell because I think sometimes you were supposed to infer that maybe some of the stuff going on was actually with Lois and not actually Hope. I don't know. It was a little confusing. Like the shower scene, that felt very weird to me. I wasn't sure if it was actually Lois in the shower and he was thinking it was Hope, or this actually happened. That's what was confusing about this issue, because some of it seemed like it could have, like Hope could have been actually been really Lois, but we didn't. Clark was thinking it was Hope.
And I think that was intentional, Drew. I think that was meant to show the sort of blending you have Shimmy and Jimmy and Hope and sort of being Lois. And you could see Clark's struggling. The implication I had, Drew, was that Clark was struggling to, like, hold on to his old life in that new world that he found himself in. You know what I mean? And I think that's what Hope wanted, too. Hope clearly, from the end of the issue, seems to imply that Hope wants to essentially seduce, lure him into staying where he's at, and him, the lines of reality kind of blurring, I thought was intentional. It was just the sequence of events that they showed us was more obtuse than I think it needed to be. I mean, you already are dealing with a framing device with the story as a whole, Drew, where we're being told what happened in the past while still seeing stuff play out afterwards, which I like, but then even within the flashbacks, we were going out of order, and that was tough.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I thought it was getting a little too cute, in my opinion, because, again, I liked a lot the general feeling that they're going for and that idea of Clark kind of losing himself, and you can see the emotional toll that it takes on him, right? When you with him and Lois at the end, like, he's struggling to, he's been lost for years, and he's years away, has no idea what's going, how this is going to play out. And you can see him struggling with that. Like, I like the idea of that, Drew, and there were scenes that I thought were really well written, but as a whole, it was just put together in a way that was harder for a reader to grasp the story than your story shouldn't be, like, work, in a sense, for your reader to understand, I don't think. You can have a mystery without it being a chore.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. World's Finest Teen Titans Number 1. A remote seaside cliff in Maine, the Teen Titans show up and stop a ritual sacrifice of some kidnapped teenagers. This team includes Kid Flash, Aqualad, Wonder Girl, Speedy, Bumblebee, and Robin. Robin is not happy that Speedy livestreamed the whole fight. Later on, the sidekicks interact with their mentors, all getting advice from the heroes who trained them. Pensacola Beach, Florida. The Teen Titans battle Jake Trask, aka the Separated Man, who is demanding a $1 billion payout not to destroy the city. Speedy fires an arrow into Trask's mouth that returns him to normal. Robin is not happy that Speedy livestreamed this fight also. Speedy was showboating for the cameras when seconds counted that cost them time. Roy comes back at Robin, stating everyone has shared their secret identity but him. Batman won't allow it. Robin storms off as Roy calls him Batnark. The warehouse district outside of Metropolis. A kid named Hilo meets with a mysterious person, stating they are building a better Teen Titans team. Hilo states his powers allow him to affect probability. The mysterious person is not impressed, and he disintegrates Hilo. He calls for the next applicant. To be continued.
This was a good first issue, Drew. I enjoyed the sort of first half of the comic where you had the Titans going back to their mentors to talk about the team and you got their different reactions. You know, like Bruce obviously preaching caution and distrust. And what was interesting was Roy being overly praising of Oliver felt wrong the whole time. I was like, it seems really out of character for Roy. And then the reveal that he's just not there at all was, I thought, pretty effective. I definitely enjoyed this first issue, Drew, quite a bit.
I did also. And Batman not wanting Robin to reveal his secret identity, so Batman.
Oh yeah.
So,
and then seeing Robin deal with that, like, you know, because, you know, it's Dick, so he's, that's not him, right? And he's trying to live up to what Batman wants, but wants like what a normal kid would want it to be, but, you know, friends with these kids. And it was effective. I thought that was very effective.
Yeah, it was. And I liked how we had turmoil in the team already. You know, it's not like everybody's clicking and getting along. It made sense for a team first forming together that there would be a little bit of headbutting. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. And on top of that, I particularly like the choice of social media being the source of conflict, Drew, because that feels accurate. And if you really want to do it's weird because, again, this is supposed to be sort of like an in-between time, like, you know, and sort of a modern telling of these Titans, but also, you know, not directly the present. But you kind of have to do social media, I think, to do an accurate teenage story, right? It just, as a teacher, Drew, it is. It's the reality. And I thought that was honestly a pretty good portrayal of, you know, different people's reactions to it, but also like the way that, I mean, some kids just live in social media and that it just is their life. And I thought the way they were having Roy, I thought kind of represented that well, where it doesn't really matter, you know, how serious the situation is. It's still, you still have time for the Instagram.
Right. And taking it from Robin's perspective, you know, he's not supposed to be revealing his identity, and being out on camera is not going to be pleasing to Batman. So I can see his conflict with that. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Unstoppable Doom Patrol number 4, The Shelter. Somewhere in Kansas, when Dr. Cinco's metagene activated, it woke a power that allowed their mind to ascend to another dimension, where they communed with five fifth-dimensional entities who wanted to help and better understand their purpose on this plane of existence. Together, they are called Jerry for short. Jerry's purpose on the Doom Patrol is to help metahumans face the emotional and mental challenges brought on by their powerful abilities. Jerry meets with Maurice, who asks to be called Degenerate. He's not ready to move forward with his therapy yet, though Dr. Cinco has signed off for him to go on team missions. It is because Jerry believes that only actions teach. Next, Jerry meets with Rita, Elastawoman, who has problems with being happy. Larry, also known as Negative Man, meets with Jerry to discuss feeling alone after finally finding peace with himself. Cliff, also known as Robot Man, meets with Jerry to talk about his anxiety about losing his friends and family. He's had multiple brains destroyed, human and robotic, but he never seems to die. This causes him to be a control freak, always worried about losing friends and family. Corelli meets with Jerry and talks about how her metagene activated one night while hiking. Her powers were out of control until the Doom Patrol rescued her, and her worst day became her best day. When the Chief checks on Corelli's progress, Dr. Cinco tells her that Corelli seems to be doing well. Dr. Cinco asks Chief if she is doing okay. Chief replies that yes, everything is fine. Even with Jane, through the artwork, tells the audience this is not the case. I gotta tell you, Cletus, while it was interesting to get to know the characters a little better in this issue, spending the whole issue meeting with the psychiatrist, I found it a little boring.
I'm of two minds with it, Drew. I liked the issue, and I thought it was cool to see that the core team had sort of worked through the issues that were, especially people familiar with the TV show, or, you know, we're used to seeing these characters a little more in flux. And seeing them having, it's apparently all kind of figured it out, really with the exception of Jane, I thought was really interesting perspective. But like you said, Drew, not a lot really happened. And that was okay with me, except for the reality that we live in with these comics and a comic like Doom Patrol. I couldn't help, Drew, but when I was like, man, I really like this issue, but how many of these are we going to get? And we spent one of them doing this. I don't know. It sucks that that's kind of how you have to think, Drew, but it's the truth. I mean, if this series hits 20, that would be a an unbelievable win, right?
Yeah.
And that, and we're not even close to that yet. And so even that, even with 20, this would be, you know, 5% of the whole story would be just them sitting in a psychiatrist chair. That's, I don't know. It's just one of those things, Drew. It feels a little hypocritical because I did like it, but I was also like, man, I don't know how many issues this is going to get, and I don't know that that's the issue that I want if I'm only going to get, you know what I mean, like a handful.
Yeah. So far, I like the Unstoppable Doom Patrol series. I hope it lasts for a while, but...
I do, too. I mean, it's good enough to do it, but it's not Batman, it's not Wonder Woman, and it's not Superman, so... That's a risky proposition.
Yep, it always is. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Night Terrors number 1. Insomnia has Batman by the neck, but Batman is not in control of his body. Deadman is. Deadman thought Insomnia was a ghost like him, but he's not. He is something else. Insomnia claims to be the god of nightmares. Deadman tries to inhabit John Dee's body while Insomnia is still in there. Deadman learns the origin of the Nightmare Stone. It was created long ago by a sacrifice, a tormented hero, and a long-lost case. Dr. Destiny used to possess the Dream Stone. John Dee stole it and manipulated it into something broken and twisted. John Dee feared that Nightmare Stone, so he hid it. Deadman also learns the origin of Insomnia. He was an inmate at Arkham Tower when the Lazarus Reigns fell. It gave him the ability to spy on people's minds as they slept. At first, it was just the inmates at Arkham, like Dr. Destiny, but eventually he started to spy on the heroes. Insomnia forces Deadman out of John Dee's body. Deadman goes back into Batman's body and escapes out a window. Deadman drives off in the Batmobile. Deadman goes to the cemetery where he uses Lazarus resin to resurrect Wesley Dodds, the Sandman. To be continued in The Brave and the Bizarre. I have not seen anything called The Brave and the Bizarre yet, so I wondered if Williamson was just kind of throwing that title out there to be cute.
Certainly possible. I would have liked a better explanation as to how exactly Wesley Dodds is coming back to life. It just sort of happens, Drew. With all of this unnecessary explanation that we get sometimes from Williamson, it's wild to me that then when it comes time to actually take some time to explain something, he just sort of waves his hand and is like, yada, 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 Sandman's alive again, but he's a zombie. You don't think that deserves any level of explanation? We're just going to roll with that?
He used Lazarus resin. I guess we're supposed to accept it and move on. I gotta say, this issue wasn't too bad. Williamson has definitely done a lot worse issues than this. It felt pretty on task for what he was trying to accomplish. That's about as much compliment as you're gonna get from me, Williamson.
It was on task. I love that. Yeah, I just don't care for his writing, and so I mean, whatever. Like you said, it was on task, sure. Well done.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week: Night Terrors, Green Lantern number 1. Carol Ferris and Hal Jordan are on a plane that is going down. Hal transforms into his Green Lantern outfit and opens the cockpit door. He is suddenly at a funeral, his father's funeral. Hal Jordan is a kid again. His mom walks him up to his father's casket so Hal can say goodbye. Hal's father climbs out of the casket in a hideous form. Hal runs as everyone turns into zombies. Hal opens the door and escapes into a hangar. He is an adult again. Now he is being chastised by Carol Ferris, who wants to know why the flight trainer isn't ready. Hal promises to have it done by the weekend. Hal hops into the cockpit and the plane takes off without an engine. Hal tries to take control of the plane, but it crashes in the desert. When Hal steps out of the plane, the alien Abin Sur is waiting for him. Abin Sur is dying. He gives Hal the Green Lantern ring and Hal puts it on. Instead of transforming into a Green Lantern, the ring sucks the life out of Hal while feeding it into Abin Sur. Before it can kill him, Hal grabs a piece of glass and cuts off his finger, severing his connection to the ring. Abin Sur chases after Hal with a construct sword. Hal escapes through another door to find himself standing before the battery on Oa. The Guardians deny his request to investigate the death of a fellow Lantern on Korugar. Furthermore, Hal Jordan is no longer a Lantern, betraying his oath by quitting the Green Lantern Corps. Hal Jordan interrupts, stating, "This isn't right. The Guardians have disappeared and the United Planets have been taken over." Hal demands to know who they are. The Guardians disappear and a monster replaces them. Hal battles the monster, defeating it. Suddenly, a voice calls to Hal from inside the battery, welcoming him to his greatest nightmare. It is Parallax. We also had a backup story in this issue, Shards of the Looking Glass Part 1. Sinestro is walking the streets of Coast City. A man walks into Sinestro and calls him an idiot for not watching where he is going. Sinestro tries to challenge him, but he is powerless. The guy punches him. Sinestro falls to the ground with a bloody nose. Suddenly, Sinestro and a bunch of others on the street are hit with a purple wave of energy. Sinestro is now a prisoner on an unknown planet. Abin-Sur appears, telling Sinestro that he has come at his weakest moment at Sinestro's return to Korugar. Another Sinestro appears before him in the ugly blue and black suit. The new Sinestro transforms into a monster. Right when the Sinestro monster is about to attack, he is zapped by another Sinestro who has a third yellow eye in the middle of his forehead. To be continued.
Drew, I really enjoyed the Hal Jordan part of the comic quite a bit. At one point, it looked like we were getting a redux of his origin. I was like, why are we doing this? And I liked when it twisted into Abin-Sur trying to drain his energy and, you know, turning it into a nightmare version of his origin. That was really cool because it played it straight for far longer than I thought it was going to, Drew. And at one point, I was like, wait, what are we doing? So that was a very welcome twist when it twisted into the nightmare. I liked that a lot. I didn't dislike the Sinestro part. I found it a little more hard to understand, which I think was kind of intentional. But the thing I took away from it, which was not positive, Drew, was an increasing sense of dread that I'm not going to like the version of Sinestro that is going to be coming out of this Green Lantern book.
Yeah, I have the same fear you do about that. I don't care for that old costume. We need to get him back in his Sinestro Corps costume. And I got the feeling we've got a broken Sinestro, and I have a feeling in the regular book they're going to be working on his story of the return to his greatness, or at least in his mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And one thing I didn't like with that, though, Drew, that I thought was silly was, so they've got this, like, broken and defeated Sinestro, right? But the artist is still drawing him as jacked, because he's a comic book character, and he gets leveled by just a schmo. And it's like, what are we doing? Like, I feel like the modern version of Sinestro has been shown to be adept at combat, first off. But also, like, if you want him to just be this, like, schmuck that gets pushed around, don't draw him with bulging biceps.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. I also like the first part of the story, too. It felt like a nightmare because we kept seeing Hal go through these different doors to different parts of his life. You know, he kept escaping through door to door, just continuing to different nightmares. So I found that interesting. The other thing I noticed is when I started reading this, what was going on apparently was going on in the series, in the regular series with them on the plane. We missed the Green Lantern issue number 2. Somehow I didn't get it. I didn't miss it. Didn't get on the schedule. We're going to be talking about it next week. I've already put it on there.
It's okay. Knowing that didn't really make any difference, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So I'm bummed we didn't get to read the Green Lantern number 2, but I don't think it really, like you said, I don't think it really made that much of a difference in the story. So we're just going to talk about it next week. So, we've only read the first issue of it. I'm kind of curious what happens in the second issue, because that first issue was really good. But for whatever reason, I missed it when it came out. So it happens. It's happened before. Not perfect.
It made no difference in the understanding of this comic.
No, it didn't. All right. Well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Night Terrors Robin number 1. Gotham City Shopping Mall. Oracle checks in on Robin Tim Drake, who is busting up criminals. Tim tells Oracle he is meeting up with Steph and Cassie when he is done here. Gotham City Harbor. Oracle checks in with Red Hood, who is dealing with a shipment of heroin that is being guarded by a platoon of inner gang mercenaries. Oracle offers to send backup, but Jason just hangs up on her. Robin Tim Drake is riding his motorcycle across town when a wave of purple energy sweeps across the city. Suddenly, Tim and Jason are thrown together into the same nightmare. To make sure Tim is real, Jason slaps him across the face. Jason states that the last time he did this, Tim turned into a bunch of little cartoon birds. He guesses this Tim is real. Tim theorizes they can die here, and Jason is afraid Tim is right. Suddenly, both heroes are in a graveyard. Hands reach up through the ground and drag both heroes into different holes. Tim ends up in his dad's apartment, where Robin fails to save his father from being killed by Captain Boomerang over and over again. Finally, the Bat family shows up, only to be killed by Captain Boomerang too. Jason must face off against Red Hood and a closet full of his mother, Sheila, who keeps repeating, "The Joker killed my little boy." As Jason battles Red Hood, he keeps multiplying into so many copies, it's just like what happened to Neo when he faced off against Smith in The Matrix. To be concluded. Yeah, I didn't care for this issue that much, Cletus.
I didn't either. This was rough. And this is sort of the downside of event comics like this, is you get a lot of these tie-ins that are frankly meaningless to the story. So it really hinges entirely on the author coming up with an interesting two-issue short story. And if they don't, this is sort of what you get, which is just kind of a mess. I did not care for this. It was, I thought, the worst instincts of what you could do personally with this event, which is just sort of like take the worst part of the character's history and just have them and just replay that. I was just like, come on, that's pretty uninspired. Also, Drew, and this is sort of my problem, honestly, with the general gist of this event, is I feel like we've seen a version of this quite a bit. Like Blackest Night, in many ways, was reliving dark moments, right? Because you're bringing back when heroes died, which is obviously the worst moment of their career. And then you've got the death metal, which is, you know, again, twisting characters into the evil versions of themselves, which was often playing on an event that happened, but what if it went bad? I don't know, you know, and now we've got the nightmares. Like, it just kind of feels a little seeming at a certain point. Like, how many times have we seen Tim deal with the nightmare of watching his dad get killed by Captain Boomerang again? I felt like I had seen that exact scene, Drew.
Yeah, we've seen that many times. And not only that, even done more is the Jason Todd Joker thing.
Right, and that was, it just, it felt so predictable and safe. Like, it was like, all right, we're going to do Jason and we're going to do Tim. And it's a nightmare issue. Oh, well, if it's a nightmare issue, we should do Tim's dad dying and Jason getting killed by the Joker. And it's like, well, that's, I mean, you know what I mean? Whereas on the other hand, Drew, if we look, for example, at the last issue we were talking about with Hal Jordan, you're going through his origin and all of a sudden he's getting the life force sucked out of him by Abin Sur. That, I've not seen that before. That's very interesting, right? Like, you know what I mean? It's still a nightmare, but it's flipping it on its head. It's taking a scene that you're really familiar with and turning it into a nightmare. What they were doing, I mean, it is a nightmare, right? But it's just what happened. And I know they were trying to play with it a little bit and make it more dreamlike, but ultimately, really, it was effectively the same thing as showing Joe Chill killing Bruce's parents. Like, my God, we get it.
Yeah, I agree with you. It would have been better to do something new instead of rehashing something we've seen over and over again. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Night Terror Shazam number 1. Mary Marvel battles the villain Shavam, helps as a first responder in a disaster, and also defeats the trickery of Count Vertigo. When Mary arrives home, she falls on a couch exhausted. Freddy and Darla wake Mary up, warning her that they are going to burn to death. They are going to need a lot of water to put out the fire. The water has all disappeared, and the house is in the middle of the desert. Mary transforms to go find water, but Billy stops her. Billy is wearing a costume similar to Black Adam. When Billy won't let go of Mary's arm, she goes to hit him. Billy transforms back into his kid form, and Mary barely stops herself from hitting him. Billy yells Shazam and transforms Mary back into her teenage body. Billy disappears. Mary runs back into the house to rescue the other kids, but she cannot find them. Mary says the word to transform, but the magic doesn't work. Back in the waking world, Mary says the word in her sleep and transforms. Mary wakes up to find everyone safe and sound. Mary believes Billy did something to her, but Billy has been at the Rock of Eternity. Mary states that she feels someone new in the world, someone evil who is poisoning dreams. Mary's dad states that that is not true and tells Mary to go back to sleep. Mary's dad looks like a monster. Over the next 4 days, Mary transforms in her sleep. On Friday, Mary's parents have decided to take her to a sleep specialist. They take a stretch taxi that has a wading pool for your feet while you ride. When the creepy driver turns into insomnia, Mary transforms and prevents the taxi from going over a cliff. When Mary arrives at the downtown sleep center, she transforms back. Mary is taken prisoner. She wakes up tied spread eagle to a vertical stone slab. When Mary tries to say the magic word, she coughs up mucus and is unable to transform. Billy appears before Mary in the black costume. This time he has Freddy with him. Billy shouts the word Shazam and Freddy is incinerated by lightning. Billy proceeds to incinerate Eugene, Pedro, and Darla until finally only Mary remains. With sweat dripping down her face, Billy leans over and whispers Shazam into Mary's ear. To be continued? Question mark.
There was a lot to like in this, I thought, Drew. I liked the idea of Billy being the villain in this nightmare, and specifically just giving him the black costume, right? Obviously makes you think of Black Adam, but also that idea that what happened to Black Adam with the champion being corrupted. I thought that was pretty effective. I thought this comic, Drew, might have been the best at sort of doing dream logic, where there was just weird stuff that happened, right? That just didn't make sense. Like, the limo is insanely long for no reason, and then there's water in it because, you know what I mean? Like, I thought this comic really got that idea. Like, it's doing a nightmare, right? But it's also doing, like, it's a dream where it doesn't really make sense. Like, there's things, like, the general plot of the story makes sense, but there are things there that are definitely dream logic that I thought was pretty effective. The only sort of nitpick that I had with this is that this, and this is totally subjective, but I felt like the story was sometimes at odds with itself because it wanted Mary to be the main character, but it felt like it couldn't also resist the tropes of like girl in a horror movie where, you know, you had some, I thought, unnecessary gratuitous scenes of her screaming. I was like, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, for me, it didn't jive quite right. I was like, I don't need that scene of Mary doing that. Can we just move on? That's just subjective. Overall, I really liked this issue.
One of the things I thought was interesting is they had Mary. Well, it seemed like Mary woke up in the real world, but I'm wondering if she actually was just asleep the whole time and she was dreaming about waking up.
Oh, she definitely was, because when she wakes up, she sees the bug. But she sort of ignores it, again, because of dream logic.
That's true, but we've also seen bug things in the waking world, too, so.
Well, yeah, but she sort of says dad, and the bug thing says, let's get you back to sleep, implying that the bug thing was dad.
Okay, I agree with you. So she was asleep the whole time. I like this issue quite a bit myself, and I think one of the reasons why it was interesting, because unlike the issue we just talked about where we were rehashing old stories, this was totally new. This is a new nightmare, and I found it interesting. I like how it focused on Mary instead of Billy. So I enjoyed this story. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Night Terrors, The Flash, number 1. Barry Allen is working on a crime scene when he gets a call from Iris asking him to come to Van Buren Memorial Hospital right now. While he took on Grodd alone and lost, he's in bad shape. When Barry reaches the hospital, Jay explains that he blew out his ankle on the way to help Wally. When Barry visits with Wally, Wally tells him the Speed Force was all wrong. There was something burrowed into it like a tick. Wally saw a monster in the lightning. Iron Heights Penitentiary. Flash visits with Grodd to get answers about Wally. When Grodd doesn't tell him what he wants to hear, Barry beats him. When Barry returns to the hospital, Dr. Fate is trying to magically close Wally's wound. It's not working. The Justice League Watchtower. Barry surprises Hal Jordan, who accidentally punches him with a boxing glove construct. Hal's face is all messed up because he absorbed a Sun Eater. Barry asks Hal to help him with the cosmic treadmill. Keystone City, the past. Barry watches as Wally takes on Grodd. The Speed Force is resisting, though, causing Barry pain. Barry tries to save Wally from being stabbed with the Spear of Destiny, but fails. As the Speed Force tugs Barry away, he sees Wally's monster. To be continued.
Drew, when I first started reading this one, I wasn't totally feeling it. I think because I've been a little burnt out by the Flash comics recently, but it really pulled me in. I was all in by the end. I don't know, it was about halfway through the comic, Drew, all of a sudden I was like, wait, I'm really into this. I like this a lot. I got really sucked into the story. I'm very excited to read the conclusion to this one because, like I said, like it started off slow for me. I wasn't really into it, but by the end it had really pulled me in.
Yeah, I have to agree with you because when I started reading it, my issue was with it was when I started reading it, I was disappointed that Barry was the main character instead of Wally because we've been focusing on Wally, but as I read into it further too, I really got into the mystery of it, and it was pretty interesting. And actually, it's probably one of the better Barry stories we've read lately, honestly. So yeah, I found this intriguing as well.
It is obviously a Barry story, but like Wally is an important factor in the story. I think that's one thing that made it better is that it wasn't just. Especially, I think that's what got me right at the end, Drew, is that it wasn't just Wally sort of off camera in a hospital bed, right? Which is what it kind of started out premise-wise. It really, you got Wally's perspective for a decent chunk of the story when Barry goes back in time. I thought that helped flesh it out more.
The other thing I liked about the story, it also hinted at Wally's ability, what we've seen in the comics. Wally has a more... He's better at the Speed Force than Barry. And I think this also kind of hinted at that.
Well, and it made me wonder, Drew, if Barry is the monster in the Speed Force. I mean, we did just see that in the movie, but that is sort of where my head went. That the thing that causes Wally to slow down is Barry going back in time.
Oh, that could very well be. It could be.
I don't know. It could be also, I thought they were hinting that maybe stuff was, like he was saying things were upside down, which obviously is sending Reverse Flash, you know, red flags up. So I don't know. I thought the comic was really effective at suggesting multiple theories of what could be happening. I didn't think it was incredibly obvious what the answer was. I don't think. Maybe it is, but.
I don't know. It wasn't obvious to me. I can tell you that.
Well, what I like is that I thought there were multiple plausible explanations. I thought the comic intentionally set up like, I think they wanted you to think maybe Reverse Flash, but then I do think it is hinting like maybe it's Barry himself, but then is it somebody else entirely? We know, ultimately we know it's really Insomnia. So I don't know. Like I said, it started off slow, but the comic really finished strong and it ended up being one of the ones I enjoyed more that we read this week.
Yeah, and this is a good example of a good cliffhanger in a comic book.
Yes.
And not agreed. Some of the lame ones we get. So I guess that's why it's got us so intrigued. All right, well, let's move on to our last issue for this week. Night Terrors, Zatanna number 1. Beneath the Hall of Justice, Zatanna was communicating with Red Tornado, who was in the Terrific Tower, until he was attacked and the connection severed. Dr. Destiny was found murdered in the Hall of Justice headquarters up above, killed by their new enemy, Insomnia. He pulled the whole world into his nightmare, including Wonder Woman and Detective Chimp. Zatanna barely managed an incantation to keep herself awake. When Zatanna went downstairs to the Justice League Dark Archives to find a spell to wake everyone, she finds Sir Morbid, Iron Maiden, and the Sleepless Queen. Zatanna realizes she cannot hold them off for long, so she magically summons a champion and Robot Man from the Doom Patrol materializes before her eyes. Zatanna orders Robot Man to guard Wonder Woman and Detective Chimp while they sleep. Zatanna has Cliff grab a book from the bookshelf. It opens a secret passage to the Magic Panic Room. Robot Man drags the sleeping heroes to safety. Zatanna has Dragon Bones attack the three villains so she can escape into the Panic Room. Zatanna and Robot Man, along with their sleeping companions, escape into an enchanted maze. They run into Dorothy and Josh, Doom Patrol members who have died. Other people who have died in a seance gone wrong appear. Zatanna and Robot Man run. Zatanna and Cliff come to a big locked door when Zatanna's father shows up. Cliff punches him out. Zatanna and Cliff get Wonder Woman and Detective Chimp to safety, or so they think. Sleepless Queen appears behind Cliff and stabs him through the back with a sword. Cliff is transformed into one of her servants, the Rustbringer. Next, hunted by Robot Man.
I didn't particularly care for this, Drew, but one of my biggest confusions was it felt like, unless I missed something, Drew, it felt like the author didn't get the memo on who the villain of this was. Was that just me?
That was just you, because they mentioned that the villain was Insomnia, the overall villain. But, you know, they're dealing with the magical people that are in the Justice League.
Sure. Yes, I understand that technically it is Insomnia, right? But it felt like, as far as the comic was concerned, it was really the Queen. And I was like, you're the only one talking about this, my dude. She was portrayed as more than just a henchman, Drew. She had her own henchman.
Yes, that's true. She was obviously the magical nightmare that Zatanna's dealing with. Though, it wasn't that scary. This comic felt like it was unfair to me, Drew.
It felt like she was, not tangible isn't maybe the right word, but like the actual... Again, I understand that the comic is aware that Insomnia exists, but it felt like she was the one making the night... It felt like the nightmares were the people in the maze. The way I'm not saying that's necessarily true, but the way the comic portrayed it to me was that the Queen was filling the role of Insomnia, right? Where it's the actual villain inhabiting the nightmare or whatever, and then manifesting the other night. It didn't feel like the Queen was the nightmare. It felt like she was the one driving the nightmares, if that makes sense. And that was what was confusing to me, because I was like, wait, that's not what we've been getting. Who is this person? I agree, Drew. It's likely that she was the nightmare threat, right? But I thought this comic did a very poor job of portraying it that way, and I felt portrayed her more like apart from the nightmare and not in it. You know what I mean? Like, compare it to the Shazam one. Billy is clearly the antagonist in that, but he's clearly part of the dream, right? He's clearly part of the nightmare. This was a lot less clear, I thought.
While you were talking there, I was just thinking. Zatanna, she's cast a spell to stay awake. So, I'm thinking about it, they're not really in a nightmare. Yeah, because she's cast that spell. They're not in a nightmare. She's dealing with magical people trying to break into the archives for something. And they're trying to get away. Because Robot Man's not dreaming either. She brought him there because he was a robot. I think you're right. I think the author was a little confused with this.
Thank you. That's what I'm saying.
Because now that I think about this, Zatanna wasn't in a nightmare, but they were doing stuff like she was.
Yes, and it was all driven by this queen. And that's what I'm saying, Drew. I was like, you have a different, like, you're writing for a completely different nightmare event right now. That was my confusion.
Okay, yeah. Now that I actually think about it, you're right, because when I read this, I was just thinking they were in a nightmare, but now that I look back at it, they weren't in a nightmare.
But they had nightmare things going on. It's possible that she is asleep, Drew, but the comic did not, I don't think, gave enough breadcrumbs to make you doubt whether she was awake or not. I don't know. I thought it was diving entirely in magic. Like I said, I felt like the author was a little bit confused and didn't. There was some sort of confused messaging, Drew, because I can fully believe that this queen is supposed to be some sort of henchman for Insomnia. Sure, but she wasn't portrayed like that, and I don't remember seeing her in the Zero issue for this either. If I handed someone this comic and they had read no other part of this event so far, there's zero chance that they don't come away thinking that that queen is the main villain.
Agreed with you, because, you know, reading this issue by itself without anything else, that's what you would think. Because you're right, she was a villain with henchmen that were taking orders from her, so that would only make sense. Anything else you want to say about this? Because if not, I'm moving on.
No, not my favorite. It was again, you're gonna, it's sort of a coin flip of what kind of comic you're gonna get with a lot of these tie-ins, because again, ultimately almost none of these felt like they mattered, Drew. So it was really a matter of, is it a good comic or not? And it was, I think, a pretty true coin flip whether that was the case, and this for me did not come up positive.
All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk the Legion of Superheroes animated movie.
Good afternoon.
May we be of assistance, sir?
Yes, I'm looking for a podcast for someone who likes that 1960s headache music.
Don't these podcasters have atrocious taste?
Sir, may I recommend this podcast by Monkeying Around? I guarantee a migraine.
I never heard of Monkeying Around.
You never heard of Monkeying Around?
He's never heard of Monkeying Around.
What does Monkeying Around sound like? I'll take it.
He took it?
He took it.
Monkeying Around, a podcast about the monkeys.
Hi, this is Jim Adams from Monster Attack, inviting you to join us every Monday night at 5 o'clock for an all-new episode of Monster Attack. For the last 7 years, we've been talking about these wonderful movies that we grew up with as monster kids. So join us every Monday at 5 p.m. right here on the ESO Network.
Let's talk Legion of Superheroes. Kara, devastated by the loss of Krypton, struggles to adjust to her new life on Earth. When Supergirl has problems adjusting to the primitive culture of the 21st century Earth, Superman decides to take her to the 31st century to train with the Legion of Superheroes. Meanwhile, she must contend with a mysterious group called the Dark Circle, who searches for a powerful weapon held in the Legion of Superheroes vault. If that isn't enough, Supergirl must also face against a new adversary with a 12th level intellect, Brainiac 5. I really like this movie, Cletus.
I didn't.
Oh, okay. This should be interesting. What didn't you like about it?
First off, I was disappointed. It's not really a Legion movie, I didn't think. Of course Supergirl's going to be the main character. I get that. But it felt like a Supergirl movie co-starring Brainiac 5, but that's not enough to make it a Legion movie, Drew. That's like having Batman and the Flash together and calling it Justice League. I'm aware that the Legion was part of the setting, but they weren't really... They literally show up in the last 5 minutes of the film. So that was a little bit disappointing, because it felt like the missed opportunity there. And then for me, I felt like what were supposed to be the big twists of the film were super obvious and telegraphed. I'm not saying this to make myself sound smart. My point is, I think that they were so obvious. I feel like most people would pick up on it immediately, especially if they have any familiarity whatsoever with the Legion, which I think more people probably do now, Drew, because of the Supergirl TV show. So it's obvious that Brainy isn't a villain, right? Because it's Brainiac 5. And they were going so hard on the maybe he's a bad guy thing that the twist to him actually being a bad guy wouldn't really be effective, right? You'd have to do it the other way around, like they did with Mon-El. But then I also felt, Drew, that the Mon-El twist was also telegraphed, because his first introduction to Supergirl, he lists some very red flag things that he likes about Krypton.
That's true. Now, what I want to say is, I didn't get the feeling that Brainiac 5 was going to be the villain. I know they were trying to telegraph it, but I never thought that the whole time I was watching it.
Maybe that's because I know who
Brainiac 5 is. You know what I mean?
Right, but I think I feel like anybody who knows who Brainy is isn't going to be fooled by their attempt to make you think he's bad. But I think even if you don't know, I feel like, again, I felt like the film was being too obvious, where you introduce the questionable character and his motivation seems suspect and everything seems to say that he's a bad guy. And then you have the, Superman stand-in, and oh boy, he's a hot hunk. But man, he said that one really questionable thing, and we just kind of swept right past that. I feel like most seasoned film watchers are going to pick up on that really quickly, even if they don't have any knowledge of the Legion. Which, frankly, I don't know how much knowledge that's going to do you anyway, because they weren't a factor in the film. there were things I liked. Like, the animation is good. I liked the voice acting. So I didn't have problems there in terms of filmmaking, Drew. I thought the story was really predictable in a way that made it unenjoyable to me, because I was just sort of, I felt like I already knew how the film ended really quickly. And I didn't know necessarily that Brainiac would be the ultimate villain in the film, but I felt like I had a basic idea of like how it was going to play out. And that was not a satisfying viewing for me. I haven't loved this idea that they've had with several of these new Tomorrowverse films, where they take a character that's supposed to be heroic and the twist is that they're actually the villain. It feels, in Mon-El's case, it's whatever because he's such a minor character. But like with Hal's, I know I keep harping on that Green Lantern movie, Drew, but it feels like such a missed opportunity to just spend that bullet right away. And I don't know that it's as effective. Again, with Mon-El, it's not as strong of a criticism because you're not going to do two Legion films. But still, even within the film, Drew, he's not a major enough character to disguise the fact that he's going to be a twist villain. He's barely, like Kara has a crush on him immediately. And then he's not in the film again, really, until we see the triplicate girl sees him at night. That's the next time really meaningful appearance of his character. That's not an effective twist. You've not done any sort of groundwork to build up that he's really actually a good guy.
Now, I got to tell you, when we first saw Mon-El, I kind of blew him off, actually, when we were watching this, because I didn't think he was going to have any sort of big role in it. I did, you know, oh, look, there's Mon-El, and that's about all I thought about it. When we came back towards the end of the movie, like when you said, when he killed triplicate girl, I was like, oh, we're going with Mon-El as the villain. It just didn't click, because I just blew him off at the beginning of the movie because I didn't really care for his character that much.
Well, I just didn't.
Probably because I've seen better versions of Mon-El. That's why I blew him off.
Drew, is that Mon-El can be an interesting character. It feels like a waste. Now, it's several magnitudes lower of a waste than Hal, in my opinion. Yes, Hal becomes Parallax, and that's an interesting story to do, but you could do a movie setting it up so that the fall actually means something. The same thing with Mon-El, Drew. I think, yes, again, I want to emphasize a much less important character, but almost always portrayed as a hero, and so you're sacrificing this twist change for a character, but then you don't really do anything interesting with it, right? He's a non-character in the film until he's the villain at the end. That's a waste of that. That is such a waste of a character.
And I didn't like Brainiac as the villain, putting Brainiacs into his, building bodies out of Brainiac. I did not care for that at all.
I also, Drew, I found the wish machine to be too vague of a MacGuffin. I thought it was a little too open-ended. I know that is what the wish machine is. It's kind of whatever you want it to be, right? But that doesn't necessarily make for satisfying filmmaking, in my opinion. At least the way they did it, because it's so vague, right? Like, Brainiac's just like, yes, I have this now, I rule everything. Like, why? You know what I mean? Why exactly? And then Brainiac 5 and Supergirl have to get rid of it for reasons? It felt like it glossed over too. Like, the only way to save it is to send it to another reality. And my question immediately for me, Drew, was, so you're sacrificing another reality? Because it doesn't seem like it's going to shut off. It feels like you're just going to have it suck up a different universe instead. And that's a positive outcome?
Maybe they should have sent it to Earth 3.
You know what I mean? Like, it felt like they sort of hand-waved that. So, like, it was just so vague at the end. I have to say... It was very effective, but it is shocking how gruesome the Brainiac stuff was, especially his demise. I know it's technically off-screen, but it's not really off-screen with the Shadow. That was tough for PG-13.
I think one of the reasons why I liked the movie is because it left me... I wanted to see more Legion stuff. I was disappointed we get to see Lightning Lad and Saturn Girl... and some of the other characters. We saw their holograms all over the freaking place. I'm like, daggone, can we actually see the characters?
That's my point exactly, Drew. It's a Legion film that doesn't feature the Legion. That's my biggest problem. Like I said, I can forgive it if the rest of the film had been really solid, but the rest of the film was I thought, mediocre. I don't think this film was bad. I didn't particularly care for it, but I don't think it's bad. It just didn't really do it for me. And the biggest reason is that it's not really a Legion film, and the rest of the film isn't good enough to make up for the fact that it's called The Legion of Superheroes and literally does not feature the team.
Yeah, I can see your point with that.
That is just such a baffling creative decision to me, Drew. And it's so, the wrap up to the story is pretty clean to the point. What's the second film for that? I don't think there is one. But what would you even do, Drew? There's no, you know what I mean? Like, that's the biggest disappointment with it, is that they did, theoretically, we got an animated Legion of Superheroes film. That's really exciting. And then, wait, it doesn't feature the Legion at all. And there's no real clear path towards another movie for it. So this is what you get. That's pretty disappointing.
We had that after credit scene with Superman and Batman.
That felt like they were getting sucked up to Warworld. That felt like a direct lead into Warworld, which I think is the next chronological film, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
That felt like a tease for the movie we know now has come out since Legion. I am still interested in that. I have found this Tomorrowverse to be hit or miss. They've been the Long Halloween Part 1 and 2, Drew, are two of the best animated films, I think, personally, that DC's done. They are phenomenal adaptations of the comic, and in ways that aren't trying to be more clever than the original comic, which is what I felt like we've gotten in some of the lesser Tomorrowverse films with Green Lantern. In my opinion, Legion, is it felt like the filmmakers were trying to be too cute or out clever the viewer, being like, ha, you thought it'd be this, but it's really this. The original stories were popular for a reason, is all I'm saying. And I wish sometimes that writers would appreciate that. So Long Halloween, I thought, was phenomenal. The JSA film, I think, is phenomenal because, Drew, this will shock you, it actually features the JSA. The whole team is actually relevant to the plot of the film, and it's not just one character.
I've got to watch those other ones. I have not seen those yet.
Those are the strongest films so far for me that I've seen for the Tomorrowverse, which I think is, I've seen all of them now except for Warworld. My favorites are the JSA film with the Flash is really good because it's actually a JSA film. It's really interesting. And then the Long Halloween's Part 1 and 2 are a phenomenal, phenomenal adaptation. And I think the two best, put together, it's the best animated story that they've done. But we've also gotten some that have driven me bonkers. This one did not drive me nuts like the Green Lantern film did, Drew. It was okay. And it was just, I was so frustrated that the Legion is not in the Legion of Superheroes film, that the other failings of the movie, which I thought was a very safe, predictable plot, weren't able to mask the glaring flaw, which is that you have an entire freaking Legion of superheroes, and we saw three of them featured majorly.
All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
Yeah, so I wanted to list the original appearance of the Legion of Superheroes, Drew. What year was that, do you think? Take a gander.
1965?
Ooh, a little bit sooner than that. It came out in, you're not far off, it came out in April 1958, or at least that's the published date, in Adventure Comics number 247, featuring Superboy and young Clark Kent, and was written by Otto Binder, who is obviously famous for Captain Marvel. Yeah. So for the first appearance, you got right on the cover, you've got Lightning Lad and Saturn Girl talking to the young Superboy. First appearance. And then they would go on in 2023, Drew, to get their first animated film appearance and not appear in it.
And for my shout out, I'm going to shout out about Shabam, because I forgot to mention it when we were talking about it, but I was wondering if that was a previous character, and apparently that was a Superman villain. Apparently the Olympus gods created Shazam to take on Superman. Shazam's first appearance was in Action Comics 351, which was in June of 1967. Peering into the future, the Olympians became aware of Superman and, believing him to be a rival god, created Shazam out of clay. Sent him to defeat Superman, he was endowed with the powers of the gods, became the leader of the United Crime Syndicate, then defeated the humbled Man of Steel. And of course, Superman eventually came back and beat him. But yeah, I thought that was interesting that this was a pre-existing character. Because I had the feeling when we read that Shazam issue that he was.
That's an interesting, you said 67, Drew?
Yeah.
That's interesting, because that's before DC was publishing Captain Marvel, and probably I would have been right in the legal gray area where they were still, they might have gotten Fawcett Comics shut down from the lawsuit, but I don't know, that's interesting. I feel like that had to have come out when Shazam was out of print.
Whoever created the character created him as a spoof of Shazam. I mean, the name's so close, and...
Well, I'm sure it was a subtle commentary on the legal battle going on between the two, or had recently concluded legal battle at that point. That's really interesting timing. I don't know the exact dates of when that was, but I know it was for sure before DC was publishing Shazam. That's really interesting, Drew.
Yeah, I thought it was. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-455-8411. Leave us a message. Or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. And you can also check out our newsletter at earthstationdcu.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Batman White Knight Presents Generation Joker. We got Hawk Girl, Batman Superman World's Finest, Night Terrors Catwoman, Night Terrors Nightwing, Night Terrors Punchline, Night Terrors Superman, and Night Terrors Wonder Woman. And the Blue Beetle movie. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.